Hey there, my name's Doug Bird and welcome to Something Fresh, where we talk to adventurers, athletes and progressive thinkers. On this show, we aim to create an environment where you, the listener, can escape, explore and learn through interesting people who've achieved great things. The idea is to help people grow, become inspired and through that, encourage them to take that first step towards doing something about it. If that's not up your alley and you're simply here to listen to interesting conversations, then that's cool too. Thanks for tuning in. Now's the time to sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey. Back in early 2018, I got the call from the local distributors of Cannondale mountain bikes here in South Africa. That is, of course, Omnico Group, asking if myself and my team would be interested in producing highlight videos of the Cannondale factory racing team competing at the first round of the 2018 UCI Mountain Bike World Cup out of Stellenbosch. And of course, we jumped at the idea because it meant we were going to be working with legends like Max Marot, of course, Enrique Avancini and Manny Fumic. Now, they're all incredible names within the sport globally from a cross-country perspective, but also fan favorites here in South Africa when it comes to the Absa Cape Epic. But of course, through that, we're going to meet their extended team. That's when we got to meet the man, Dan Hespeler. Now, Dan Hespeler is who we're going to be chatting to today. He's from Germany, of course, and he's been riding for a long time, started racing at the age of 14. He's got a degree in economics, and he enjoys marketing, that is for sure. And his title now, in terms of what he does as a job, is he's the Global Senior Sports Marketing Manager for mountain biking for Cannondale, and he's also the team manager for Cannondale Factory Racing. Now, Dan's got a big job to do here. On one hand, he's got to wear a marketing hat when it comes to selling Cannondale bikes all around the world, but at the same time, he's got a dynamic management role to play within the team structure because it's about individuals, it's people, it's performance, it's training, it's a lot of travel. And those two portfolios, so to speak, live within the same ecosystem. If the team's doing well, it's great marketing. If the bikes are selling, it means that the team is strong because it's well-funded. So it really is an interesting and dynamic role to play, and it's a role that he plays really well. We, of course, went on to filming the Absa Cape Epic in 2018 after the cross-country event went successfully, and we worked with them again in the same portfolio in 2019. So having spent some time with Dan, it's been an absolute privilege to work with him, and even greater privilege to catch up with him for this edition of Something Fresh, where we talk to him about how he manages his roles, his love for the sport, a little bit about his economics degree, and his views on where the sport is at right now from a global perspective. I hope you find it informative. Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, today we are speaking to Daniel Hespeler. He was, of course, all the way from Germany, living in the Stuttgart area. And it's an absolute honor to have him here on Something Fresh, another podcast that is brought to you from the sunny skies in South Africa. Dan, how are things going in Germany at the moment?
Well, first off, hello, Doc. Hello, everybody in South Africa. And I'm very well here in Germany. And really looking forward to talking to you over the next few minutes, hours, or however long it's going to take.
Well, Dan, tell us, obviously it's on everyone's lips at the moment. Coronavirus is a pandemic. It's affecting everybody. We've got very strict measures here in South Africa with lockdown, complete lockdown going till the end of April. How are things in Germany? Because I see from your Instagram, you're able to at least ride your bike.
Yeah, I think it's a bit different to what you guys are experiencing in South Africa. We are still allowed to go outside and we can ride our bikes. We can go to the office if we want to, but every employee also is free to choose to work from home. I think the biggest thing that is here is restaurants, bars, and public places are either closed or limited to two people maximum. So I think that is the biggest thing we have here where we have a different life than normal. But to me, you know, not a lot changed. I'm usually working from home or from the service course, and I do the same at the minute. The only thing that really is different for us as a race team at the minute is we don't go racing.
Of course, and that without a doubt would, I'd imagine, come with its own types of challenges. But I guess we'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But to kick off the conversation, those of you listening in, the reason that I'm so excited to have Dan on the line with us today is because he's a man that has incredible experience when it comes to being a professional sportsman himself. He's a well-studied individual, of course, has a university degree in economics and sports marketing. And he, as I said in the introduction, is, of course, the manager of Cannondale Factory Racing. and he's the global senior sports marketing manager for MTB and within the broader company that he works for. But unpack that for a little for us a little bit there, Dan. What does your day-to-day job look like?
Well, that's going to take a while. I mean, I separate my jobs a bit. One is what you said last, which is the sports marketing side of things of my job, which is where I'm working with the marketing department, which is where I'm working with all other departments in the company. I'm involved with my vote, at least, in major decisions on sports marketing strategy and on the ways we execute things. I'm obviously not deciding myself because we're a big company and there's a lot of people from a lot of different areas in the company that all come together on frequent basis or on a regular basis and, you know, just discuss and suggest what is the next thing we do. Obviously, there is a lot working with engineers as well, just because we are a bicycle company and we race bikes very fast. So our input is quite important for them. And then there is the team job, where I'm the team manager, but I would call myself more an operations manager or a general manager of the whole thing. I'm overseeing every process on the team, but at the same time, I generated most of the processes on the team as well. And it's planning logistics, it's finding the right people, it's finding the right sponsors, it's frequent calls with athletes and staff just to keep everybody in the loop of what's going on. And then obviously, I think the biggest part of my job really on the team side is being in close exchange with Phil Dixon, who's our performance manager and who runs the team together with me, just to set everything up in the right way the athletes and the team can perform.
So in other words, you're a very busy man and there are many balls in the air all the time for you, because as you described in one of our earlier conversations before the podcast, is your team is for the most part based all around the world, different time zones. That must be quite a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really good in juggling usually with the balls. If I would, you know, if I would do that myself, it would look really funny because I just can't do it for some reason. But doing it with the team, it's quite a challenge, but it's the challenge I enjoy because no day is the same than the other. And there is always something new that comes up, situations arise, and you just need to find the right ways of dealing with these situations and solving them in the best way. So nobody's harmed or we are actually walking out of every situation as some sort of winner.
Mm. So, I mean, of course, to get to the level that you've summarized now within your job and your working life, you've obviously traveled a journey to get there. And I guess this is the perfect time to almost take it back to the beginning and give all the listeners a bit of context as to your journey, as to who you are and how you are best suited for the position that you're in now. So, I mean, as you say, managing a team of athletes, you're managing coaches, you're managing high performance people, you're managing dietitians, mechanics, strategies, all those types of things. Tell us about your athletic journey as a kid growing up, and in particular your journey in cycling.
Me growing up is like living on the countryside with my parents and my sister. My whole family was always kind of involved in sports, but not really in cycling. First professional, like sports that I was following, calling it professional would be wrong, but you know, sports that I was doing on a regular basis and really was focused on was skiing and running, because the two of them, they usually come together, because in the summer you run to stay fit and in the winter you go skiing. When I say skiing, I say alpine skiing, so down the hill. We had a ski lift just about 3 kilometers from my house or from my parents' house. And the next step really was, since I was very competitive at all times, to just start ski racing. That was my first sport that I really followed. I was quite okay in it, but at some point I figured out that I'm not the right build for ski racing because I'm way too small and not heavy enough and not strong enough. And then there is way more talent in me for endurance sports. And, you know, from running, then I somehow came to cycling because my dad always rode his bike, and but never on a really, you know, he wasn't a sportive bike rider or whatever. He just loved to ride his bike. And out of this, the two of us kind of pushed us to always the next step. And we started from road rides to mountain bike rides. And then, you know, we just got into it. And he was probably my biggest supporter over these times. And yeah, I ended up being a bike racer, signed on for the local club, and then worked my way up like the regional federation selection. And then at some point I found myself being on the German national team.
Now, to get up to that level of riding is incredible, because as we know, South Africans, when we view people that are racing for a German national team or a Swiss national team, for the most part, you're right at the top of the game globally, so to speak, because the pedigree, at least the racing intensity and speed in Europe, is world class from the very beginning. But in terms of getting to that point of being really fast, what kind of structures and support do you get from, I don't know, government institutions or provincial institutions, university coaching? You know, what are your structures like in Germany to support young and up and coming athletes?
I'll probably come with a surprise for most South Africans, because the situation in Germany around cycling or around the structure of cycling is not as good as everybody would think. So cycling is not a part of school sports at all. School sports is only soccer, athletics, swimming, all the ball games, you know, like handball and tennis and whatsoever. But cycling is not considered a sport at school. So if you want to get into cycling, you got to get there by yourself just because you enjoy riding your bike. Then you need the support of your parents and then obviously the support of your local club. And I think this is how the base structure works. And then from your local club, you possibly selected for the regional team. And then from the regional team, you possibly selected to the next step, which is like an area of Germany, and then from there you possibly selected for the national team. Once you're selected for the regional teams, this is when it starts to become a bit more professional, and there is coaches that help you. But most riders that make it somewhere in the sport, they invest heavily in themselves, getting their own coaches and working with their own people and generating or creating the right group around them to bring them to where they want to be. Just because there is no such thing as a huge cycling structure in Germany, and most of other European countries are the same.
It's quite crazy when you think about that, though, because it's always, I would say, and I'm probably going to make some enemies by saying this, in South Africa, it's almost an excuse to say, oh, we don't have the facilities and we don't have the support. In reality, though, if it's similar in Germany and other European countries, then I guess it's more about the process of what people are following in terms of their training, their nutrition, and their equipment, more so than support. It ultimately comes down to your own commitment, dedication, and work ethic.
Yeah, I think it's there is a few exceptions. I think the French and the Swiss system is quite good, but what I can generalize for Europe is Europe has like a huge cycling history. And I think this is what a lot of people refer to when they say, okay, there must be a structure as well. But it's actually not like this. Yes, most of the races happen in Europe at the minute. And that also could make you think that there is all this structure and all these supports, and it's an easy path that you just follow and you're going to be up there. It's not like this. I think the only advantage Europeans currently have, if they want to race against good competition, they can stay in Europe and do it there. And other continents, and I include South Africa also, because we have the situation with Enrique in Brazil, I think those two have very similar situations. They always have to travel, and to travel you need money, and you need time, and you need to adjust to different circumstances or to different cultural things that are given. So I think this is the negative point when you look at other continents compared to Europe in cycling especially.
Absolutely, it makes sense. So in terms of your professional racing career, your competitive racing career, rather, as you summarize it, between the ages of 16 and 23, you raced for your national team across mountain biking and cyclocross. Now, cyclocross is a sport that we see on our sports channels here in South Africa from time to time. And whenever it's on, for the most part, everyone's watching because it looks like absolute insanity. Tell us a little bit about cyclocross racing, because I'd argue that it looks to be one of the more physically demanding types of cycling in the world.
Yeah, just coming back to like my starts in cycling, it was actually at the age of 12 already when I started. Mountain biking, I pretty much started when I was 16, because when you're younger, you were not allowed to ride mountain bikes, because there was a bit of a structure then, and now I'm kind of talking against what I said before. But in the clubs and in the regional teams, you are kind of forced into being a road cyclist first to set the basis, and then from there you build into the different disciplines. And that's what I also did. So started a lot with road riding, then got into cyclocross, and once I was old enough, which was at the age of 16, I got into like serious mountain bike racing as well. Coming back to cyclocross, back in the days, it was just a way for road cyclists to ride in the wintertime. And the wintertime in Europe, in most places, is longer than the summertime, way longer. So the idea behind it is you ride in the forest, or you ride not on the road, at least. With that, you're riding slower, therefore you don't get cold that quick. You ride on technical terrain, which helps you to get better in your technical riding skills. And you do all this on a bike that is very similar to what you would use when you do your races as a road rider. So I think this is how it all came together. The race format that developed out of that, I think, is one of the best in cycling in general. It's really short. It's 1 hour. There is the same rules than in all the other races. There is the start gun that goes, and after 60 minutes, you do your last lap, and the first who crosses the line is the winner. And it's 60 minutes of flat out on a really short circuit or course that has natural obstacles. And it can be in the forest, it can be on grass, it can be on pavement, it can be on gravel. And usually it's a mix of everything. Sometimes you even have to run and carry your bike because, you know, it's either too deep of mud or too steep of a climb. And it's just a real crazy spectacle for the spectators to watch it. So I think it's a really cool sport, and I think mountain biking and cyclocross, they're very similar in their approach, also how you train for it and how you approach the races.
In terms of developing your technical skill set, I'd imagine that cyclocross adds a lot of value there, because, as you say, you're essentially riding a road bike with knobbly tires. Sure. I mean, and a lot of the conditions that we've seen broadcast on our channels here, it's cold, it's raining, it's slippery. It really must add a lot of value to your strength, but also your technical riding ability.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, riding on these really skinny tires with tiny little knobs on them, and, you know, with drop bars and with a position that is actually not made to ride off-road, it's crazy demanding, but it's a nice challenge, and it's actually quite some fun. And I mean, when you just look at athletes that are really good in mountain biking, a lot of them actually have a history in cyclocross as well.
It's fascinating. I mean, if you look at a guy like Mathieu van der Poel and what he's managing to achieve in three different disciplines of the sport all at the same time, it's fascinating to see how multi-talented a young man like him is. Yeah, it's exciting to watch.
Yeah, true. And I mean, you picked a very good person for that, because also one thing that everybody or most people probably don't know about him, it's when you build into races, and when you build towards winning races, you need to be in the situation. You need to have been in the situation to win a race before. You don't just ride through the field and then all of a sudden you're in the front and then you win the race. And I'm talking now World Cup level, right? So you need to experience what it feels to ride in the front and to be able to win a race. And in cyclocross, Mathieu is such a talent and is so ahead of everybody else that around, I think, 35 times over winter, when everybody else just rides the bikes, either in South Africa for some Europeans or even in Europe, he has that chance to actually be in a race situation and hone his racing skills and his technical skills. And I think it plays a massive, massive role in his success in mountain biking and also on the road.
He's a fascinating athlete to watch. I'm very excited to see how his career evolves over time. Do you think Cannondale's going to find enough money to get him over to the Cannondale team?
I think he's locked in some serious contracts for quite a while. Plus, I also have this feeling his ambitions are more focused towards the road. So not sure if this is something we are really interested in. But obviously, I think he is, at the minute, the biggest cycling star across disciplines and probably is the one that is following Peter Sagan. So and he has some big shoes to fill.
Absolutely. Well, that journey will unfold in the next 5 years. But going back to your career, in terms of riding, where did you start to move away from being competitive in the sport?
When I started racing mountain bikes, I was quite successful. I was on the national team, but I was never this kind of winning rider. So I never won any of the big races or national championships or something like that. I was always in the top five, but I never really won. And at some point, you know, you gotta think about what you do in the future, and if you can actually make it. And for some reason, I think I kind of was done with bike racing as a professional, real professional career. And then during a winter in, I think it must have been 2003, maybe, I broke my kneecap while skiing. And I mean, I smashed the left kneecap in two pieces with the right edge of the ski. And yeah, it was just an injury that is not really good for riding your bikes and building a career on your knee, actually. And I think I took it as a very good excuse to just say, okay, that's it from here with the professional riding or with putting all this effort in and trying to become a professional, like a real professional that makes a solid amount of money and can actually make a living out of it. And yeah, I just probably was ready for the next step.
And that next step, Dan, how did that happen and what did it look like? Did you decide to focus on your kind of university career or where did it lead you? Where did you go from riding bikes and being competitive to next?
Yeah, so I mean, I finished school, I finished high school, and then in Germany, we have to do either do the army or like a civil service kind of thing. I opted for the civil service, where I had like a job for that was supported by the government for sportsmen, and I only had to work half the day, so I was really, you know, I had time to train a lot and to think a lot as well, and it was clear for me that at some point I will go to university, and I was always interested in economics and I was always interested in marketing, so yeah, I mean, next thing is I just signed on university and aimed for a diploma in economics, which is what I did. To finance all that, I found a job on Team T-Mobile at this time, which was probably one of the best mountain bike teams in the world and the most professional run at that time. And yeah, I found myself being the head mechanic for that team in no time, and just financed my university and my studies with that. And with that, again, I stayed connected to the cycling scene and, you know, just made the next step or created a bigger foundation for what was to come.
And take us through what was to come, because you essentially have joined one of the biggest cycling sports groups in the world, if you consider all the brands that it holds, and has also got one of the most cutting edge and progressive brands at the forefront of that in Cannondale. And it's been a great journey for you so far. I think you noted 15 years almost that you've been with that company. Tell us a little bit about that story, because that's quite a big shift, moving from kind of professional race mechanic, you know, the head of that for Team T-Mobile, to moving to a more corporate role. That must have been quite an interesting transition for you.
Yeah, it actually was. So you're right. I'm 15 years. This year, I was actually 15 years with the brand, which I don't know if too many people have been there for 15 years, at least in a row. So quite proud of that as well. As you probably know, the cycling industry and also the racing scene, then in the cycling industry, it's a pretty tight group of people. And once you're in there, you know pretty much everybody. And once you know pretty much everybody, you also know where the jobs are and you know what could come up. And I knew a few people that worked already at Cannondale, and it was as a cyclist, it's a brand that most people admire, or a lot of people admire. So when I had the opportunity to join the company, I was just like, all right, let's jump in my car and go to the interview, which is what I did. And I mean, my first job was not at all connected to sports marketing or whatever. I had a normal marketing role, and I did like dealer events and visited dealers and helped them market their products to the end consumer, did clinics on a tech and on a marketing and on a sales side with them, and just helped at events in general. So I was part of the marketing group. But in my interview, and that was one of the first things that I said to the CEO at that time, is that I have a huge interest in sports marketing and in bike racing, and that this is where my knowledge is. And, you know, it didn't take too long for them to then propose a different position for me. So I did that job that I mentioned for a year and a half, and then already moved into the sports marketing department.
So Dan, moving from being the head team mechanic for Team T-Mobile at a World Cup level, but then moving into a more corporate role and one that you hold now and have evolved over time, must have been quite a big step change in many respects, not just in terms of your actual job description, but in the way that you mentally approached your new position. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you went about adapting?
Yeah, I mean, coming from university, that's pretty much what you get prepared for, you know, diving into the corporate world. But I wasn't exactly ready for that. And I definitely wanted to work in the bike industry and in the field that I know. Then also, when you've worked and spent most of your life in racing or in the cycling industry, you know people, and then, you know, one thing comes to the other. And there was this opportunity at Cannondale where I knew a few people. And yeah, I just jumped in my car and went to the interview for a job that had nothing to do with racing or whatsoever. It was more a normal marketing role, coordinating and running demo events at dealers and doing sales, marketing and tech clinics in shops. So being on the road quite a bit, and I think that's what kind of pulled me into that job as well, just because I've always been traveling for racing, and keeping traveling was kind of interesting to me. And I made pretty clear in that job interview already that I have big interest and quite some knowledge in sports marketing, and this is where I want to go in the future, ideally with that brand. And, you know, things came together, and after about a year and a half, I stopped the original job and moved into the sports marketing department. And this is where I still am, in a different role now, but I'm still there.
So in terms of that progression, though, and moving and unpacking what you do now, I mean, earlier on in the podcast, we talked about what your typical day looks like. But now I want to start to unpack that in a little bit more detail and kind of take a different angle to the questions that come, because, you know, not only do you have a responsibility in a corporate sense to be driving such a crucial marketing aspect of your overall strategy, but now you're also responsible for a very human element of that too, which is people, it's athletes, it's coaches, and all those types of things that we talked a little bit about earlier on. But you've been part of developing this structure from the very beginning. How did you go about developing the structure? Did you know exactly what you wanted to achieve from the outset, or was it more focused on a process that would evolve over time that hopefully found the best of both worlds?
I think it's a bit of everything, obviously. So coming into this whole thing, I was actually responsible for the freeride side of things and the downhill side of things, which was nothing I had done before. Because I mean, I came from endurance sports and, you know, from cross country road and cyclocross and all that. So, but it was something that I really liked, at the time for myself as well, because that was kind of the riding I did. And I got a bit into motocross as well. So it all kind of fitted well together, because the downhill was just where things were open at the time when I was there, and where there was an opportunity for me, because our cross country teams had been outsourced and they have been run by an outside agency. I mean, I had pretty much all the things you needed. I worked as a mechanic. I was a racer myself. I worked with team managers before as an athlete, and so I knew what the job would be. And from there on, I just, you know, put the pieces together. And luckily, the company gave me, I would say, all the freedom in the world to create the racing programs the way I would see them. And I did that first for the downhill program and for the freeride athletes. So I kind of restructured how we did everything. And then when the time was right, and that was in 2008 for 2009, where the contracts ran out for the cross-country side of things, I just got faced with the opportunity to build something complete new there as well. And I think this is this will fill a few more minutes very soon.
Yep, absolutely, because that's where we're heading now. I mean, it goes without saying that Cannondale Factory Racing is our South Africa's favorite, or the team is South Africa's favorite international racing team, without a shadow of a doubt in it. And it all started back, I think, when the boys arrived out here in baggies and trail shorts to race the Epic, Manny Fumic and Marco Fontana. I don't think any South African that follows the sport of mountain biking very closely will ever forget that. Was that pure marketing genius, or was it just a case of, we don't look great in Lycra, so we're going to wear trail shorts?
Yeah, I mean, that whole baggy short thing started even a bit earlier than that. But just crawling back to the beginning of CFR. So CFR, as we know today, started with a white piece of paper that was in front of me. And again, I had all the freedom in the world to create a next level of a cross-country team. Because we had what everybody else had before. Contracts ran out and we could renew things. And I was just faced with that white piece of paper and making suggestions to the boss at that time on how I see the sport and what we could do and how we could get the most out of the sport. Now, looking at cross-country racing in 2008, it was pretty much the off-road version of road racing. Mountain biking in Europe on the World Cup level wasn't that cool, really, in my eyes. Everything I'm saying is in my eyes, okay? It wasn't really appealing to me, because the athletes were kind of untouchable. There were not real characters out there that actually got support to be characters. There was a lot of characters, obviously, but they got pushed in like the old school team dynamics where, you know, you go to a race, you do your training run, and then you jump in a car, get brought to a hotel, do your massage, eat, sleep, wake up, get as late as possible to the race just to not be there and being exposed to fans and all this. Do your race, win, do the podium, and disappear. I hated that, because that, to me, is not professional sport. Professional sport, to me, is a show. And professional sport, to me, needs another component other than just, okay, we do the race and whoever's the winner is the winner, and then we're all happy and we go home. This is how it all started, and that was when I said, okay, this white piece of paper needs to look a bit different. We need to be appealing to our fans. We need to do things that people wouldn't expect from a professional cross-country athlete that is an endurance athlete and pretty much all they do is suffer. What we want to show is that it's quite enjoyable to actually ride a cross-country bike and even race it. I mean, we always knew that it's painful and it's hard and, you know, you need a lot of training, but we just wanted to make it look very, very appealing to people, and we wanted to inspire people to do the same. And we did a lot of little things. We changed the pit setup that we had, and we made it open to people. We made people come, and we made media come. We had the athletes for way more time at the race venue. And with that, I think we started a big trend as well for these big European World Cup pits that you see these days. And I think it just was something fresh for the scene. And when you look at it by now, pretty much everybody does it like that. I'm not saying I invented it or whatever. We just did things in a different way. And doing things in a different way also led us into the whole baggy short thing. As I said, I came from the downhill racing side of things, and I always gave the guys from beginning on like podium baggy shorts. And we always had discussion how cool it would be if mountain bikers wouldn't race or ride in Lycra. And at some point, and it was in Nove Mesto at the World Cup, Fumic, just when he warmed up, he was in his podium baggy shorts, and he said to me, "Listen, Junge, I'm racing in these." I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yeah, I'm sure." And I mean, he raced in them, and I think he finished sixth in that race. So he proved that it's a top 10 capable concept. And it was just his normal podium shorts. I mean, they were not special at all. And from there on, the whole thing kind of developed and evolved. And yeah, we got it to the point where we actually had quite competitive materials and a competitive system that was specifically made for racing. And that was probably at the end of 2013, 2014. The Cape Epic we did kind of in the basic setup. And I heard from a lot of people that it was kind of a shock to the South African mindset, because when you do the Epic, you need to wear Lycra and you need to do this and you need to do this. And we just did something different. But we saw it not so much as a race that we wanted to win, or where we wanted to have like an impact on the overall or whatsoever, because we didn't have any experience. So we just went there, did it, walked away with stage wins even. And yeah, just had the greatest time of our lives. And yeah, alongside that, we made some impact, which is great, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that's where the love affair of with the team started for South Africans, that's for sure. Because as most people around the world, everyone likes something that's a little bit different and talkable. But I mean, a lot of what you've brought to the conversation now in the last couple of minutes is the team and the team dynamic and the riders within that structure and how you guys get everything done. Talk to us a little bit about your team structure, because to achieve the outcomes that you have consistently and so consistently, almost from the very beginning, one could argue, you've obviously had to have the right people in the right places. So what does the Cannondale Factory Racing team actually look like?
Yeah, I go through history again, if that's cool. It might take a bit longer, but you just tell me now, is it cool to take a bit longer, or do we do the short version?
Let's go long. Yeah, let's. I mean, we're on the podcast here, and this is all super interesting. So yeah, let's go.
Okay, the long version is, again, I just explained everything what I did in 2008. For 2009, we started with the team, and it was me and a good friend of mine that was racing bikes together with me, that I went to university with, that we actually shared an apartment with. So I was the team manager at that time, and he was the sportive director. He by now is a doctor of economics and works in a really high level position in a metal manufacturing company. So he's not really into this anymore, but he started his professional career away from the bike with the bikes in racing. And we just, you know, we set it up in the way that I was the one that was responsible for the marketing side of things, for the logistical side of things, for the organizational side of things. And for everything that was connected to Cannondale, he was in charge of putting together the race schedule, working very close with the athletes, and kind of managing the sportive side of things. He did that for 2.5 years and then decided to follow different things in his life, which I already mentioned what that became then. And that was from 2000. end of 2010 on, where I pretty much ran the team by myself. So starting with like a team that had a really good balance in between making a marketing impact and having a performance component. We moved into something where I was the sole leader of the team, and that was from 2010 until 2015. We didn't have a sportive leader at that time. I thought I've learned enough on that side of things to actually be able to run it myself. And we just, you know, we went with what we knew and what we got. Every athlete had their own coach. They did their own training camps. They did the preparation by themselves. And the team was really just responsible to market them and give them the right surrounding to perform. And I even do not call it just the surrounding. I would call it the stage to perform on. Because one of the key criteria in me doing the things I do them is looking at bike racing in the way that the athlete in my world is the rock star, and the team or the sport is the stage. So no stage needed if you don't have the rock stars. No rock star without a stage. So the two things, they go in line with each other, and you need to have both of it. And you need to give a rock star a stage to perform. The better the stage is, the better the rock star will perform. And this is either on the performance side of things or on the marketing side of things. So from 2010 on, I got the opportunity to get Manny Fumig on the team. He, with his brother, had his own team, and they just ran out of energy, I guess, to run the team. His brother also retired, and Manny was a bit in the air of keeping going with his career. Since we've been longtime friends, and I've been working with them, obviously, at T-Mobile, I just made him a contract offer, and he accepted. And from there, I think one of the greatest stories of a mountain bike team, at least from my point of view, right? I mean, I'm involved, so I can say it, just started, because I already had Marco Fontana at that time, who was, without a doubt, one of the biggest characters in the sport. And all of a sudden, I had Manny, who looks very similar to Marco, acts very similar to Marco, but still they are very different. And the two of them just created, in my world, the marketing dream, because what can you market better than brothers that have the same vision for things and push things in the same direction? So I was in a situation where, you know, this team was about to go through the roof. And I think we did. The years 2011, 2012, 2013, we were quite dominant on the circuit. And at the same time, we were really interesting for media, and were able to tell some really interesting stories. So I think that is when we then started the Cape Epic and all these kind of things in 2013. But from there on, things went not sideways, but didn't progress on the performance side in the way I wanted them. We tried to fix a few things along the way, nothing that we tried solved the issues in the way we wanted them, and we just struggled a bit with performance. So I think this is the first part of the history of the team. And then in 2015, I made another big step in changing the team around. Yeah, so as you know, when everything in life works in some sort of waves. You know, you have ups, you have downs, and after every up usually comes a down, and after every down comes an up again at some point if you do the right things. And it was the same for us. We had these massive success seasons in 2012 and 2013 with being on the World Cup podium all the time. We never really won, but we've always been there with one or two riders on the podium. We won an Olympic medal with Marco. And then, yeah, started the Cape Epic approach, did very well again in 2013. But for some reason, we kind of fell in a hole in 2014, and we just couldn't deliver anymore. And I think it's a lot is connected to the rockstar theme again, and a lot of rock stars have that. So you're always in front of people and you excite people, and people are inspired by you. And then, you know, at some point you will fall in a hole. And I think this is what we experienced, and we couldn't really find the right tool to get out of this. At the same time, we are a race team and we needed performance. So I was just sitting down and thinking, okay, well, what can we change? What can we do? Because the athletes we have, they're very special individuals. They have their very special ways of doing things. We created this team to not be like any other team, not be like a mountain bike or an off-road version of a road team. So all these structures, will they work with the athletes we have? Will they not work? And I was just on the search for somebody that could help me again on the sportive side, which I had for the first 2.5 years and didn't have anymore. And then, you know, I was just on the search again, because this was the only way I could improve the general impression the team made. And it was in Andorra in 2015, so around July time, when I had a conversation with Phil Dixon, who's now the performance manager of the team. At that time, he was still, and I think he wasn't actually the British cycling or mountain bike national coach anymore, but I think he worked for a downhill team, but he was at all the World Cups, and we've met before, we knew each other, and he always impressed me with the questions he asked. And the questions he asked, they always led to something, and they always kind of challenged me or whoever he asked the questions to get a bit better in what they do. And out of this, we just decided, okay, we need to work together somehow. I needed to find the budget, and I needed to also convince the athletes that they possibly will be faced with some changes on the team structure that they might or might not like.
Now, that Dan, would come with its own challenges, because as you highlighted there, you know, these are people that have their own ideas, their own processes, their own emotions to deal with. And to essentially be moving someone from outside of the structure into the structure with such a influential and crucial role that they would be adopting, that must have been quite a challenging process to manage.
Yeah, it was not just challenging to manage. It was actually quite some risk, because don't forget, we've been in year 2015 with the year 2016 being an Olympic year, Olympics usually being around July, August timeline. I think it was Rio, so it must have been August, around mid-August. So that's about 8-10 months before one of the biggest race in 4 years. We changed the team structure around. I did it because I knew we needed a change. I did it because I trusted the people that I had in mind for this, and I put it in the way that it was an additional offer to the athletes that they could choose or not choose, knowing that when you give an athlete that is convinced about something and the way he goes to achieve goals, when you give them somebody else on the side who gives them ideas and suggestions on how to change things, it could go totally wrong. I took that risk. And I think long-term, it proved very well. Short term, it proved okay. We didn't win a medal at the Olympics, but we had some bad luck, and I think we were in a very good position to actually win medals. And from there, what you could call CFR 2.0 started, and that's something that still followed the idea of the rock star in the stage, still followed the idea of inspiring people, but at the same time adding in step by step a bit more of a performance structure that we try to make appealing as well to the public. So now, for everybody who doesn't know what I mean with the performance structure and the marketing approach. Usually when you look at an athlete or at, look at an athlete, and the athlete has like a cake, and the cake is the time he can invest in things. If you chase performance, all pieces of that cake need to follow performance, right? That means there is no piece of cake that can be used for marketing. So every piece of marketing that you do, because marketing is time consuming, right? And it's not just time consuming, it's consuming mental energy, it's consuming physical energy. It's just a consuming piece. So everything you do actually takes away from that cake. So whenever you speak to a performance person, they'll be like, no, this is not what we do, because we want to win races. Is winning races our goal? Yes, winning races is our goal. So we need all the pieces of the cake. And so my biggest challenge really from that point on started in dealing with pieces of cake, giving as many to the performance side of things, but taking as many for the marketing side of things. And I think currently, and we are in 2020 now, we are at we're very close to the sweet spot of having like a high performance program with a really good marketing component to it.
Yes, and I guess that's probably the next phase of the conversation, is because ultimately you work for a corporate, and from their perspective, the stage and performance measurements are, yes, of course, results in terms of people on podiums, but it also comes down to selling mountain bikes, because that's in essence what I would assume the overall objective is. By investing into teams, by investing into athletes, is you want your gear out there showcased in the best possible way by the right type of people, and seen in the media in a certain way. You know, you guys very clearly invest a lot of time and strategy into your own digital media channels. How do you balance that aspect? Because everything you've talked about so far around the team structure is obviously really personal, as in people, emotions, feelings, performance, all of those important things. But we all know that corporate can be pretty rigid sometimes. That must be also quite a challenge to manage the corporate outcomes that the directors want to see versus the performance outcoms and the wins that the team structure wants to see.
So the ideal scenario for every company that invests in sports marketing, and I mean, we are a sports goods company. I mean, we produce bicycles. Every company like that's dream is to have a winning athlete or team that tells appealing stories, is easy to, or is inspiring people, and is easy to deal with. So this is what every company or most company wants. Obviously, there is some companies that just want to win. That's all. And their marketing is purely based around winning. But I think there is not too many of these anymore in these modern times, just because marketing and social media and activating around what you do became so important. So obviously, what all the companies are looking for is, I'm trying to make a good comparison, is trying to swim without getting wet. If that makes sense. Does that make sense?
That sounds interesting. Unpack that for us.
Yeah, because it's impossible. Because it's impossible. Yep. You can't swim without getting wet, right? And winning races and being the most admirable person, being open-minded, being spending time with media, spending time on social, combining that with the performance program that you need nowadays to win races is not possible anymore. I mean, this is just not happening. But that's obviously what everybody wants. So ultimately, what you have to aim for is a compromise. And I think this is where my job role comes into play, in finding the right compromise. And finding the right compromise is always connected to filtering things. So I have to filter the athlete's needs of, I need this, I need that, and I need time to rest, and I need this and this and this and this. Need to filter that out and give to the corporate side just what they need to know about it. And then also from the other side, from the corporate side, there is a lot of things the athletes don't need to know or shouldn't know, or what is just not helping them to do what they have to do. So my job role is really a combination of being a salesperson, which because I need to sell the things one side does to the other, and then vice versa, and then a filter. And because I need to filter what comes from one end and shouldn't reach the other end, or maybe I think it's not good that the stuff reaches the other end, and so I filter it. But like every filter, at some point the filter is full and it's blocked, and you need to either buy a new filter, which would be replacing me, which I don't want because I love my job. So you every now and then just need to, you know, unblock the filter and then go again. I think this is pretty much in pictures describing what my job is.
Now, I mean, outside of your job, from a personal perspective, if you're looking to give a bit of advice to aspiring athletes, you know, a subject that I'm really passionate about is the discussion around how when kids are basically competing in everything up to under 18s, you know, they generally have support from their families, equipment, accommodation, transport, all of those things are taken care of. But we see between ages of 18 to racing in the senior categories, that under 23 category can be almost a black hole in many respects, because you see a huge volume of people with amazing talent just falling off the wagon, so to speak. I guess other life temptations present themselves. But what advice do you have to youngsters looking to bridge that gap and to stay in the mix to being able to achieve their dreams?
I think it needs to be split in like you did, in it needs to be split in two groups. One group is the juniors and, you know, everything below, let's say, 17 years old, and then everything above 17 years old, because I think that's where the cut is. Maybe it's not 17, maybe it's 19, but, you know, we can move that that fence. But I think we need to really diversify in between the two groups. And speaking about the younger group, and that's from whenever you start to ride your bike and enjoy riding your bike and think you want to be competitive in riding your bike, I think the key piece is you have to enjoy. You shouldn't do anything on your bike that you don't enjoy, because that's going to catch you at some point later, and you don't want that to happen. That's number one. Number two is you need to find your own way of enjoying what you do and getting to where you want to get.
Sorry, Dan, to jump in there. So I also just want to touch on it now, and that you're not suggesting, though, that, you know, there are going to be days on your bike, no matter how good or how much you love the sport, that you are not going to enjoy your ride. I mean, there's going to be times where you have to dig deep, that you have to suffer. I mean, that's just part of the process. So I just wanted to clarify that, unless I'm wrong, Dan, but, you know, overall, you need to be having fun. And
yeah, you're totally right. I mean, when I say don't do anything that you don't enjoy, it doesn't mean you should not ride when it rains or when it's cold or when it's miserable, or you should turn around when it goes up the hill. I mean, I assumed, and I based my statements on, I want to be a bike rider, and I know that bike riding is not always fun. But at the same time, you know, you need to enjoy what you do, and you need to figure out if maybe you find even some joy in riding in the wet, or you find some joy in breathing your lungs out on that 17th repeat on a climb. And if you don't enjoy that, you most likely will, if you don't enjoy that when you 14, you probably won't enjoy it when you're 25. If you enjoy it, you already set a base. And this is kind of what I try to say with you. You need to figure out if you enjoy what you're doing riding your bike, but that obviously comes with times of not enjoying. I don't know any single thing in the world that is only joy. It's just not happening. Right?
Well, yeah, not for this conversation.
Not sure where you want to go, but I even if I would go where I think you could want to go, I think it's not just joy. And I don't even know what you were talking about. Anyway,
let's leave it there.
we leave it there. I mean, for example, I mean, I have sweets in front of me now because I'm a bit hungry, and it's the quickest thing to eat, which gives your blood sugar level a bit of a push, and you know, you feel great again. But you only feel great for so sweets are actually fun to eat and they taste great, but there is a downside to them because you turn fat at some point and you're going to fall in an even bigger hole later. So, you know, even sweets have a downside. That's what I'm trying to say. Make sense?
Fair enough. Yep, absolutely.
Okay. So, going back to enjoying. So I think up to these 17 to 19 year old, you need to enjoy. Obviously, you need to push and you need to suffer and you need to do all that. But you need to enjoy and you need to appreciate whoever supports you. Most likely, this will be your parents. You need to appreciate and be thankful to them that they do it. Then from there on, I think this is when it gets a bit harder, because usually in most areas in the world, people have to start thinking about how they make their living at the age of 16, 17, 18, 19. And if you want to make your living, you either need to learn on a job or to commit to a job, or you need to go to university. And that all comes with distractions from what you did before, which was riding your bike and going to school and have to not worry about too many other things because you are still with your parents and all that. And I think this is the spot that you mentioned where a lot of talents and people or bike riders fall off the wagon. And I think it's actually good it is like this, because it's just natural, because people make decisions in their life, and this is a time in your life when you make big decisions. And the ones that are left over, I think they need to then swap to thinking about what they enjoyed so far in that time when they started the bike to where they are now, and make that into a profession, because that comes with more pain, probably more pressure, more disappointment. And if you're lucky and good, with more joy, but it's not a given. And I think this is the real hard part. But also for that, you need to write down your recipe to your way of getting to success. Surround yourself with the right people. Create your core group of people that you trust and that can give you advice and can help you. And out of this, there is a really good chance you're going to make it as a professional.
Further to that, though, we've seen the world of the athlete, though, evolving a huge amount over the last decade when it comes to digital media and social media, where nowadays, more than ever, athletes have a lot more, I would say, influence over their brands, you know, how people see them, because they can create their own platforms. How important is it in terms of ratio for you as a team director, as someone that is always on the lookout for new and up-and-coming talent? How important is it for you to see athletes investing a fair amount of time in developing their brands? Because the reality is that you can't perform and be at the top of your game all the time, 24/7, 10 years in a row. You're going to have ups and downs, which you've talked about earlier. But that's where I guess it's so important to have a strong brand as an athlete, where, you know, people stick with you through those tough times. But in terms of the overall package, how important do you see that being as someone in your position?
I think it's very specific to the person that you look at. So there is no like base recipe to that. And I'm saying that because some athletes, I roll back a bit. I say that because if you want to be relevant on social media these days, or on media, or being relevant in the bike scene, you need to have results, right? So without results, you're not getting relevant. So usually what comes first is the results, and then making them relevant and activate around them. There is a few examples probably out there where people first got relevant for a small group, then added success on top, and with that got even more relevant. But I think usually the way it works, first there is success, people get inspired by the success, and then you need to start telling the story around. And now when you ask about the process of selecting athletes, I always look at the full package. I look at the potential on the sportive side, and then I imagine how that would look when you grow it. And then trying to grow alongside, I call it the marketing side of things. If I have a good feeling that you can grow both, it's usually a good choice. if you try to grow the sportive side, but the marketing side of things will not grow alongside, it will not be an athlete that is relevant to inspire people to ride bikes or buy bikes or do everything a brand wants them to do to fulfill their goals. And sometimes, you know, you just look at the marketing side of things and then you think, okay, now if I try to make that athlete better in the on the performance side of things, what's happening then? And if the performance side is to be increased, but the marketing side can't go alongside, it will actually decrease, it's maybe not a good choice. So that it's a very, very complex way of looking at it. And a lot is, in my eyes at least, based around the feeling for people. And this is probably one of the key factors if you consider calling yourself a manager, because you need to be good in finding the right people, analyzing people, figure out how they tick, and then try to optimize them in the way you want them to work.
Well, I mean, it goes without saying that you've managed to achieve that successfully with Cannondale Factory Racing now, just through the performance and the types of characters that you have on the team. I mean, I remember looking back now, going back to when Marco was still part of the team, there was an edit released, and I'm pretty sure it was with Manny as well, where the guys were racing around. It might have been in Germany, but they're racing around in some European streets on road bikes and then on scalpels and just showing off their talents. That for me was a really inspiring piece of content to see guys having fun outside of their racing scenario and showing their skills on bikes and just riding for, I guess, the love of riding. How do you keep that aspect of the team alive? I suppose it isn't just your sole responsibility. I mean, everyone's ultimately responsible for their own happiness. But how do you keep that consistent motivation going in the team, that consistent positivity? I also say that in the sense that we've worked with you guys at Two Epics. We know that there's some tough moments and there's some pretty direct conversations that have to happen. But 99% of the time, you guys are all working towards the same goal and you seem to be able to just figure your shit out. How did you develop that process?
I come with an example, you know, with two or three that kind of link together. And maybe, you know, one is a saying in Germany and maybe it kind of translates into English. So the basis, you can't make a horse drink. The horse needs to choose to drink by itself. The German saying kind of says, you can bring the horse to the water, but you can't bring the water to the horse. Right. Yep. So what I'm trying to say with that is athletes need to enjoy what they do deep inside themselves. If they wanna whatever, ride around for fun on a downhill bike, it needs to come off them. Sometimes it doesn't, because they feel oof, somebody who is into the sport and sees me riding a downhill bike would think I'm not serious about what I'm doing. And with that, the way I'm seen in public might not be the right way. So now I come to my part of the job. We go to a race, and before we go home, all of a sudden, I would want the guys to ride around on a downhill bike because I think it could be a cool story. So I don't go to them and say, listen, here is the downhill bikes and you now ride it around and look like you have fun. So what I do is I just bring those bikes to the race. And before we all pick up, I mean, they're just there leaning against the truck. And there is a good chance one of them's going to jump on them and they're going to ride around it and have some fun and have some laughs. And then the next thing I'm saying is, well, just take it home. And then there is a very, very good chance, it's about a 98% chance, that I'll have the video I wanted in a matter of 2 days. If I would have shipped them a downhill bike and say, listen, you jump on this and do some crazy stuff, I will never have the video. It's just about how you approach things. And you need to obviously have the right characters that are open to this. And out of these two criterias, you usually get quicker or not so quick what you want to achieve.
How much of your professional riding career do you think added value to you being able to facilitate these types of opportunities or facilitate these types of structures in the team, because I would say that, you know, having been an athlete, having been in those positions has really helped you identify and connect with athletes on a much deeper level, because you can relate to them. You understand the context of what they're going through. But also added to that, you know, maybe perhaps a bit of corporate experience when it comes to the psychology of how structures can work. It kind of comes together in a really powerful package. Is that something that you were aware of happening to you as a person as you evolved and adapted over time and became better at what you did? Or were you kind of at 5 years later realizing, looking back on things, wow, this has been an amazing journey and it worked itself out on its own?
Like everything in life, I think it's a combination. So, well, I started being a bike racer, so that I didn't plan what I do now when I became a bike racer. Then I needed to make some money to finance my university, so I became a bike mechanic. I think once I was done with that, and the combination of working as a mechanic and studying economics and sports marketing, I kind of felt, okay, now I need to add another few pieces to the puzzle, and I'm going to be probably a very close to above average manager of a team or a person that can run projects in sports marketing, because I have this package of experience that I then obviously build more that is needed for the job. So again, it's a bit of, you know, what I love to do, plus then adding in what I thought is needed to get better. And then learning about a few things that I actually never wanted to learn about, which is psychological things, because I don't really like it. But to understand human beings, you need to invest in learning about it. And out of that, I think I just created the package that I am now.
Well, Dan, it's been fascinating to talk to you, to hear your views. One last question before I wrap things up with you here today is, what is your view on the current mountain biking, in particular, global landscape? Where do you think the next big opportunities are? Where do you think the next big sport of focus is going to be? Where do you see products going? Because we know things are definitely getting more expensive. I was reading an article the other day about the pricing of bikes and so on, and the way that that's going, but also with things getting a bit more tighter economically. But then also you're looking at the sportive aspects of it and the effects of Corona. What is Dan's view on mountain biking in the world at the moment and possibly for the next 2 years?
Oof, that's going to take another hour for me to talk about that. So I'm not sure if you have that much time. So I mean, again, I enjoy so much talking with you about all this, because it's really nice fallback in history for myself as well. Because, you know, usually when you by yourself or you're working, you're always forward looking and you never really reflect what you actually did. But now the question was for forward looking, for not for history things. So let's start with the racing perspective. At the minute, the situation is very special with the virus and nobody really knows what's going on. I think bike racing and competition, let's call it in general, is implemented in human beings. And there will always be some sort of competition and you always want to beat somebody else. So therefore, I think the future for mountain bike racing is quite bright. If some decisions are done in the right way and it's getting more relevant in the whole landscape of sports that are there to consume for people. Because I see cross-country racing and downhill racing, which is the two big disciplines of mountain biking, as sport that needs to be consumed by people on site at events and in front of their TV. And then out of that, the participation in the sport starts, because people feel inspired by what they see and they start riding the bikes themselves. So that is my concept of how it all works. Obviously, at the minute, there is e-bikes, which are crazy fun to ride because they take away a lot of the pain of cycling, especially when you start with cycling. Because we all know as active cyclists, the first few weeks when you get back to cycling, they're horrible because it hurts. And then you get to some point and it kind of is all right and you enjoy. And, you know, from there you get better and better and better, faster and faster, faster, less pain, less pain, less pain. With the e-bike, you kind of not have that anymore. So I think it's a really nice tool for people to enter the sport. And then out of that, they either stay with the e-bike and are limited to the 25 kilometers an hour or like whatever, 28, 29 in the US. Or they decide to go with a bicycle that can actually go faster, which is the one without engine. And I think there is a great opportunity there to grow the whole sport of cycling. Plus, there is obviously still the road bikes that are very, very popular. There is gravel bikes that allow you to ride a bit off-road, be away from cars and all the traffic that we have in the world. So to me, it's very positive. And especially also with the crisis or the coronavirus situation at the minute, I think it's a huge opportunity for cycling in general and for the bicycle, because it will be a tool to move from A to B and enjoy along the way even more in the future. So that is, I think, my outcome. And I really wish bikes also make the next step in regards to how they look, how they feel, and what they offer to you as a riding sensation. But working in the industry and working in one of the most innovative brands in the scene, I kind of have a bit of an inside look in what's coming in the future, and I think the future is great and bright.
Well, I think that's a perfect and uplifting note to thank you, Dan, for your time and tuning in with us today. It would have been awesome to link Manny in there if we'd been able to, but hopefully we can catch up with him in some shape or form in the coming weeks and months. But yeah, Dan, thanks once again for your time all the way from Germany. It's been really insightful, and no doubt that everyone that's listened into the podcast has learned some valuable lessons from a man that is without doubt at the top of his game with one of the strongest racing teams in history and doing some great things. Thanks, Dan.
Well, thanks to you, Doug, for having me. At the same time, as I said, I could have spoken another hour about things, and I really, really enjoyed it. So whenever you have another hour spare time, I'm happy to come back because there is a lot more stories to tell. This said, everybody stay safe in South Africa, one of my favorite spots in the world. And as you guys all know, we spend a lot of time there. Hope everybody's safe. I hope everything passes very soon and without too much damage. And I'm really looking forward already to our first training camp, most likely in December, and seeing most of you guys possibly eye to eye again. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, man. We look forward to that. Thank you, Dan. Cheers for now.